Okay. So. Okay, let's try. Can you see? Is it? Oh, it's not focused. Yeah. It's a little bit small. Okay, so it's a great honor for me to start this week. Thank you very much. And so I would like to discuss the following topics. It's optimal volume preserving transportation problems. And the outline of the talk is as follows. So we start with an infinite dimensional Riemannian geometric problem, which is the problem of looking for shortest paths, the L2 lengths, on the group of volume preserving diffeomorphism of the unit cube. So I will explain in detail. So this is really an infinite dimensional problem. And I will mention a very interesting negative result obtained by Alexander Schnirlmann some time ago. And I will see how, by using a numerical approximation involving permutation and combinatorial optimization, we can get analytic idea to solve this problem and to introduce a correct relaxation of the problem in terms of convex analysis and the solution that can be given to the problem. And at the end of the talk, and in order to connect my talk to last week's topics, I will show you that as a byproduct, we can obtain the Monge-Kantorovich optimal transportation problem, which was discussed a lot of time last week. So it's, in some sense, this will be a way to close the loop. Yeah, this one is better actually. So maybe I should switch to the. Oh, and to turn off the light, he said. Which one? This one? Yeah, better. Thank you. Okay, so let me start with this geometry problem. So we are looking at geodesics on the group of volume preserving map of the unit cube. So we take marginally a nice bounded domain in RD. So, well, in all the discussion, I will take the unit cube. And we can consider this space, which is usually denoted by S diff of D, which is made of all diffeomorphism of D, which have a unit Jacobian determinant. So this is an incompressible map because of the Jacobian determinant condition, this map will preserve the volumes. And of course, we can consider this as a subset of the Hilbert space of all square integrable maps from D in the Euclidean space, because these maps are bounded. Okay? And so this gives at least a formal Riemannian structure on S-diff, because S-diff is embedded in a Hilbert space, and therefore we have, at least formally, a concept of length to define geodesics. And now I am interested in the problem of minimizing geodesics, of, if you wish, the problem of finding a shortest path between two given diffeomorphism, and more specifically because of the group property, and this is a group for the composition rule. So we mainly discuss the shortest path between the identity map, which is the unit of the group, and some given H, which will be a map given in the set of diffeomorphism. And so, analytically, the problem amounts to look for a path, a time-dependent path, on the set of volume-preserving diffeomorphism, and to minimize this quantity, which is the... We take the time derivative of the map, and we take the L2 norm, time, and this is a way to define shortest path, and the infimum will be denoted as the half the square of the distance between the identity map and the H on the, this group of maps. Okay, don't be afraid by the square. I mean, the geodesic can be defined with or with a square or without a square, but it's much more convenient for analytic purpose to keep the square in the definition. Okay, so this is the problem that we would like to solve both analytically and numerically. Okay, just to tell you the relevance of this problem, I remind you that this problem comes from fluid mechanics, because by differential calculus you can check that classical shortest path minimizing geodesics must satisfy the Euler equation describing incompressible fluids. So, I mean, the details of the equation is not important, but the main feature is that when you look at the second time derivative of this family of map, then, and you do the composition with the inverse of the map, then this equals some potential. Physically speaking, it's the pressure of the fluid. And this pressure is not explicitly given to you, it is just the Lagrange multiplier for the incompressibility constraint. So, if there were no incompressibility constraints, the simpler solution would be for the point, transportation along straight line, but of course this is incompatible with the incompressibility condition, and this is why you have on the right-hand side this Lagrange multiplier. So the connection between the Euler equation and geodesics on group of volume-preserving maps is very famous, especially after the work of Vladimir Arnold. And so I will refer to this book of Arnold and Hessin for more details. And I should say also that the outstanding problem in nonlinear PDEs is to solve the initial value problem for that in three dimensions. And this is not the same problem I am going to discuss, because here I am discussing a minimization problem where you know the map at the initial and at the final time, at time 0 and time 1. So you are looking for a shortest path between two maps, and in the initial value problem it's different. You are given the initial map and you are given the direction, and so you are looking for geodesics in a global way. So it's two different problems. Okay, so maybe this is not so important, so I will not maintain this transparency on the... And so now I would like to talk to you about this result by Alexander Schnirlmann. And he showed that if you take a map, capital H, which is a volume-preserving diffeomorphism, an area-preserving diffeomorphism of the unit square, so this is a 2D map, and this is capital H. So then now you can lift capital H as a three-dimensional map that I will denote by little h just by adding the third coordinate, like this. So this is clearly a volume-preserving map in a rather trivial way. And therefore, you can compare the geodesic distance between the identity map in 2D and the capital H on one side, and on the other side, you can look at the geodesic distance between the three-dimensional identity map and little h. And you can compare the two numbers, and a priori, we have a large inequality, because we have more candidates, we have more possibility in 3D, we have many more possible motion between this map and this one than in 2D, because here we have a two-dimensional constraint. Therefore, we have a large inequality, but Schnirlmann showed that there is maps for which the inequality is strict, which is very, this is very sensible, because if you wish to move something in the square, well, you will have a lot of some kind of topological constraints, and the motion will be very slow. But if you can use the third dimension, you can be much faster. So this is very sensible, but it's not... Well, you have to prove it. So this is what he did. And as a consequence of that, you can see that for such maps, the three-dimensional problem has no solution, no classical solution. That is, if you have impossible to find a classical shortest path between the identity map in 3D and little h. And the construction is not so difficult. It's basically the point that the three-dimensional, any three-dimensional candidates to achieve the minimizer will be not satisfied, will be genuinely three-dimensional because of this inequality. But then there is an easy slicing process or lamination process that can make the energy even smaller. So each time you have, you just laminate it, and this will make an even better candidate. And of course, this will never converge because the candidate will try to be more and more two-dimensional without being two-dimensional. So this is the explanation, basically. So what to do? What to do? What to do is one of the favorite expressions of Alexander Schnirelmann, I think. So they say, what to do? And so we can do numerics or relaxation techniques. Well, and of course we can do, there is a rather obvious idea is that volume preserving map at the discrete level correspond to permutation. So more specifically, the idea is as follows. So if we have the unit cube, we can split the unit cube in small subcube d alpha with same volume. And what will be a discrete volume preserving map? This will be just a permutation of the cubes, right? So given a permutation of the n first integer, we will just shift subcube d alpha to subcube d sigma alpha. So this is like a discrete incompressible flow. And by the way, let me remind you that there is, in combinatorial optimization, there is a classical relaxation of permutation, which is obtained by... but I guess you are the expert. We are the doubly stochastic matrices, that is matrices mu alpha beta with non-negative coefficients, and the sum of each line and each column is 1. And this clearly permutations are included in this set, and therefore the convex hull, because this set is convex, the convex hull of permutation, permutation matrices is included in the set of doubly stochastic matrices, but because of the marriage lemma, there is a theorem by Birkhoff saying that the convex hull is exactly the set of doubly stochastic measures. So we will keep in mind this idea. Maybe I can put this. Well, at the continuous level, we can guess what could now, I mean, we can guess quite easily what can be the relaxation of the group of volume-preserving diffeomorphism by more or less using the same idea, but at the infinite-dimensional level. That's a good candidate for the relaxation, which will be this concept of doubly stochastic measures. So what are there are measures, so ds, I will denote this doubly stochastic measure always by ds. So there are probability measure on the product space, t cross d, and they have the property that, each projection of mu is the Lebesgue measure. So this is a joint measure for the two copies of the Lebesgue measure. And so more specifically, if you integrate, if you take a Borel set capital A, the mu measure of A cross D and the mu measure of D cross A, D is the whole space, which should be the Lebesgue volume of A. Right? And there is an embedding. So to each diffeomorphism G, you can associate a mu sub G, which is defined in the following way. So the mu sub G volume measure of A cross B for two Borel sets is the volume of A cross the intersection of A and the pre-image of G of B by G. And this is clearly doubly stochastic because so this is a usual break every morning at the same time when the truck is coming up, right?
It gets used to it.
Yeah. And so it's doubly stochastic because if you take, for instance, B to be D, then G minus B will be G minus D, that is D, and therefore this will be the volume of A. And the other part is even simpler. So we have this embedding, and it turns out that this is a dense embedding when you put the vague topology on the probability, the weak topology on probability measure. And this is like a folklore result, and I think the best reference is a paper by Niretin about 10 years ago. So I will discuss a little bit of, as shortly as possible, of numerics, because this was really important for me as a motivation. The computational motivation was essential, and therefore I would like to discuss a little bit of numerics. But not too long, because it's... Well, the idea is quite straightforward in a numerical way. That is, you fix the number of subcube, you introduce a time step, you approximate the final map given to you by... So I should keep... maybe I can keep this. Yeah, you do this approximation, and therefore, you approximate the final diffeomorphism by a permutation, and then... you try to solve this ugly minimization problem. That is, you look for a sequence of permutation and you minimize the sum of the square of the displacements. The x alpha are the grid points. And so, you know, the k index refers to the time. So this is like a time difference of the two-volume preserving map. Right? So x sigma alpha k minus 1 is the grid point chosen by the permutation at step k minus 1, and this is the next permutation. So this is like the time derivative. So you integrate in both alpha and k, and this gives you an approximation of the quantity you would like to minimize. And of course, you have to fix the boundary. That is, the first permutation will be the identity permutation, and the final permutation will be a suitable approximation of the final map.
Don't require any kind of continuity.
No, that's the idea. Yeah, there is you completely ignore the continuity. And so, in practice, how to solve that? This is a big combinatorial problem, but there is a rather straightforward way to do it. You do it in an iterative step, and so, like in a Gauss-Seidel way, that is to say, well, when you know, for instance, two neighbors, k minus 1 and k plus 1, you optimize for the permutation in the middle, for the midpoint. So, maybe it's... Well... And therefore, each step consists in minimizing something like that. So you are looking for a permutation. So you have two given permutation on the side. So you already know. This is a part of the iterative procedure. And now you update the permutation in between. And this is a linear assignment problem, actually, which we know that we can solve in the, at worst, capital N cube steps. Maybe I skip the some details of the computation. And computationally speaking, it turns out that there is you can improve the efficiency of the linear assignment problem in the 1D case, because this is a very special linear assignment problem. And in the 1D case, you see these x alpha are just real numbers. There is just one coordinate. And this problem, I mean, you just compute a little bit, and you see that to solve this problem, it is enough to sort in the increasing order the average of this list of number and this list of number. So this is just a sorting algorithm in 1D. So in 1D, we have a tremendous improvement of the efficiency of the algorithm because it goes down to n log n. And therefore, it is very tempting to do one-dimensional calculation. But this sounds to be crazy, because if we look at the definition of the group of diffeomorphism in the 1D case, it is trivial, because we have map that have Jacobian determinant equal to 1, diffeomorphism of the unit interval. So the Jacobian determinant is a derivative, so it means that the derivative is 1, and therefore you have only the identity map. So the problem is trivial in 1D. It's trivial, but not so trivial, because of the following fact, that if we extend the concept of volume-preserving map not to beyond diffeomorphism to any Borel map that are volume-preserving in measure theoretic sense, like this one. This is a one-dimensional map. This is clearly not a diffeomorphism, but it is volume-preserving in the measure theoretic sense. So you have the slope 2 minus 2. So if you look at the pre-image of a small interval on this side, there will be two copies with half the measure. And so this is volume-preserving map in the measure theoretic sense. And the nice thing about this kind of map is that if you lift them to three dimension, just by taking H, so this, there is a bad notation. This should be a capital H here. Okay? Here should be a capital H. But this can be shown to belong to the L2 closure of the group of three-dimensional diffeomorphism. That is to say, there is a sequence of diffeomorphism, volume-preserving diffeomorphism, that converge in the L2 sense to this map, to this lifted map. So which means that these one-dimensional maps, although they seem to be completely irrelevant from the point of view we started with, they belong to the closure of our configuration space. And therefore, it is attempting to do computation with such maps. And such a map can be approximated by permutation. So I gave you an example with 6 grid points, and you see how you can approximate this map by a permutation by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, will be approximated by 1, 3, 5, 6, 4, 2, for instance. So this is a way you can do computation. And therefore, in 1D, it's pretty easy. You have just to do a bunch of sorting problems with this kind of permutation. So it's a rather easy algorithm. And just, I would like to show you, before moving to the analytic part of the talk, this is more the intuitive part of the talk, I hope. And so this is a kind of picture you can get. So I should explain a little bit. So this, in each block you see a typical this is the graph of a permutation. So I put a cross in each for each one, and nothing for the zero. And so this is a numerical geodesics, for instance. So we start from the identity map to the hat map, this one. We do an approximation like this, but with 400 points. And we run the algorithm. So this is what we get in between. So this is the evolution from the identity map to the hat map. And you see and you can check numerically it converge. No problem. When you refine, you will get the same structure more and more. So you see, typically, the structure, there will be a one deterministic part and this fuzzy part, which they like a mixture. So let me show you another geodesic. So the final map now is like this. So it's one-to-one orientation preserving and with a big jump. And here the map, this is a permutation in between. Here this is fully deterministic. And another example on the edge. This. And in between, this is just for fun, this has no physical reason I know, I computed a harmonic map instead of geodesic. So it's a two-dimensional thing. And so on the edge, you compute geodesics, and then you fill in between by in a harmonic way. And you get this kind of picture. Okay, so now I think it's time to move to the analytic part. Maybe I can put that on the side. Yeah, so now how will we do the relaxation of volume preserving map? Yeah. So we know in a static fashion we had this idea of using doubly stochastic measures. But doubly stochastic measures are not enough because in defining the geodesic, we define really some kind of arc length. So the time evolution is extremely important. And so it is not obvious how to put this differential structure on the set of doubly stochastic measures. But there is a trick, which is the following, that we can call a generalized path, which is, I mean, for those who were here last Friday, this is basically the same technique I described last Friday. So you introduce a time-dependent pair of measure. So mu of t will be a doubly stochastic measure. But there is a companion measure, which should be, it's a measure on the product space, just like mu, but it is valued in Rd. It's a vector-valued measure, and there is no constraint doubly stochasticity. And they are subject to this balance law, to this, so this is written in the distributional sense. When you differentiate in the distributional sense the doubly stochastic measure mu, this should be in balance with the x divergence of capital E. And now we can do the embedding of a smooth path into a generalized path. So mu, this is straightforward for mu, given a path on the group of diffeomorphism. Mu will be just the delta measure concentrated along the graph of G. And so this makes mu a doubly stochastic measure in the same way as we saw a few minutes ago. But the companion measure is mu multiplied by the time derivative of G. So this is the velocity in some sense. And now this, we are in good shape to define the metric, the Riemannian structure, will be lifted to the generalized path in the following way. We just take the E is absolutely, will be absolutely continuous with respect to mu, so we can take the Radon-Nikodym derivative of E with respect to mu. We square it and we integrate that along mu. And E is essential in this construction. I don't know any way to define, to generalize that using only mu. And this turns out, I mean, it's not obvious from this writing, but this is a convex functional of mu and E. You can write that as a Legendre transform, and this is really convex. So in some sense, we have not spoiled the convexity of the cost, which was quadratic, but the big thing is now, instead of the Jacobian determinant constraint, which was highly nonlinear, now for the doubly stochastic measure, we just have these constraints that each margin of mu is fixed, which is a linear constraint. So in some sense, now we are in the process of replacing our original problem by a convex minimization problem with a convex cost and linear constraint, like an infinite dimensional convex optimization problem. And therefore we can do a theory for... Yeah, I should keep this here.
10 minutes. No. So what is now the relaxed problem? So this is very easy. So this will be a definition, if you wish, of the geodesic distance on the set of doubly stochastic measures now. So from mu0 to mu1, what do? You look for a pair mu e subject to the balance law. So here I use the compact notation divergence for this operator. Right? This is divergence in x. So subject to this balance law, we would like to minimize this cost subject to the constraint that mu should achieve mu0 at time 0, mu1 at time 1, and that and mu should be doubly stochastic. Anytime. And this problem has actually a dual formulation, which is this is really just a very elementary convex analysis to show the duality. But the dual formulation is interesting, at least for the people who are familiar with the Monge-Kantorovich situation, because we have something similar. So we have the supremum over two scalar functions phi and p. Phi depends on the all variable, the time, x and y, the duplicated variable, and p is actually the Lagrange multiplier for the incompressibility constraint. This plays the role of the pressure, and this is a function depending only on time and space. And so we have this supremum with these linear terms. So phi at time 1 integrated against mu 1, phi at time 0 integrated by mu 0, plus the integral of p. And this is subject to this Hamilton-Jacobi-like equation, the time derivative of phi plus 1/2 of the gradient squared of phi plus the pressure less than 0. Right. Well, in fluid mechanics, this kind of relationship is known as Bernoulli law with the equality. And now we can prove a theorem out of this. And the theorem is the following. So the transparency is very bad. The size is very dense. So we look at the unit cube. We take Schneeuwelmann's data, that is two-dimensional maps. And we consider the problem when mu zero is the correspond to the identity map, and mu1, the final doubly stochastic measure, is given by the two-dimensional Schneeuwelmann's map with this easy lifting in the third direction. And the first thing to do is to do an explicit construction to show that we can achieve a path with finite energy, which is not obvious. I mean, it's not clear that you can always find such a path. And it's a general fact that whatever mu0 and mu1 are, there is a universal bound for the geodesic distance, and which can be done by an explicit construction. The trick is you go from any mu zero to the completely chaotic doubly stochastic measure, which is dx dy, where everything is mixed, and then you essentially follow straight line, but in such a way that the average speed is always zero. And in such a way, you manage to get an incompressible motion, and this gives you a universal bound. This bound is not sharp. I mean, this would be interesting to know what is really the geodesic diameter of this doubly stochastic measure. Here, there is a big gap with the diffeomorphism when we work in two-dimensional case, because it is known that the geodesic diameter of the group of area-preserving map is infinite. This is a result of I forgot. Well, maybe this will come back to me. This is a symplectic reason. And so, which means from this you already see that using doubly stochastic measure is really linked to three dimension and not to two. This is not a good relaxation for two area preserving motion. This is a good relaxation for volume preserving motion. And so the result is the following, that first of all, this minimum in this very large set of measure can be reached by smooth path on the group of diffeomorphism in the following sense. We start from the identity map. We almost reach the final map. Here we allow some discrepancy of epsilon. And it turns out that we can achieve the classical cost to be almost equal to a lax cost. So in some sense, this is because of the three-dimensionality. In some sense, the Eliasberg and Ratiu. Eliasberg and Ratiu prove that the geodetic diameter in 2D is infinite, and therefore it is impossible to do the same with two-dimensional diffeomorphism and to achieve exactly the final map. This is not possible. And so a more constructive result is the following, that you can show that for attached to this minimization problem, there is the dual variable P has a unique solution, actually. This P is unique. And so, from the analytic point of view, I mean, what is relevant is the gradient of P. Sorry, I should have said the gradient of P is unique. Some partial regularity result shows you that this is a locally bounded measure. And this gradient of P drives all the approximate minimizer, in the sense that we have almost the Euler equation for the G epsilon. That is the second derivative in time of G epsilon composed with the inverse map weakly converge to this minus grad P. So this grad P is really attracting all the minimizing sequence. In spite of the fact that you may have several minimizing paths, but the acceleration field is unique. That's an interesting feature, I think. So let me show you the equation of geodesics in the standard case. So we have the balance law we saw. The optimality condition for E is to have a density which is a gradient, and we get the Bernoulli law for phi and p. So this is formal because there are some difficulty to prove this relationship, which is in some sense true only mu almost everywhere. And mu can be a very nasty measure, highly concentrated. So I don't know how to do that, to write that. The only thing I was able to do in the paper was to prove the following extension of that you get formally by differentiating this, taking the gradient of that and multiplying by mu. So you expect this relationship, and we can show that this relationship is correct, and this pairing makes sense, which is not obvious because mu and grad p are measures, but there is a way to just see the pairing. And so I would like just to show you, because this has two relationship of the discussion of last week, but which is about this very nice concept of displacement convexity due to Robert McCann, and just to show you that at least formally, here we have very easily the displacement convexity of the Boltzmann entropy along this geodesic path. It's just, I mean, you just compute using this differential structure, which I think is the nice way to compute displacement convexity, in my opinion. And so computing the second derivative of the Boltzmann entropy, after a few lines of calculation, of formal calculation, you end up with the right-hand side, which is mu times the second derivative of phi squared. And so this is definitely a non-negative term. Therefore, the Boltzmann entropy displacement convexity is true in this framework also. At least formally. It will be interesting to prove it rigorously, actually. And so now I would like to end the talk by, well, I mean, this is slightly arrogant to say that it's a toy problem, but this is like, you can see that as a byproduct of this theory of relaxed geodesics. So maybe I can put back this transparency. Well, we can try to do exactly the same thing, but in a simpler case. That is, what happens if we consider, instead of the doubly stochastic measure, just the probability measure on D? So disregard this constraint about being... And so we can do exactly the same construction. We define the distance on the set of probability measure by minimizing the same quantity and with a generalized path mu e. The only difference with the previous case, it is just simpler because there is no y variable anymore. This measure lives on d and not on d cross d. So we have this simplification and we keep the balance law. And so we have a concept of distance on the set of probability measure. And it's not a surprise that this is the same as the Monge-Kantorovich this quadratic distance, sometimes called Wasserstein distance. And in some sense, this is a rephrasing of the Otto's Riemannian description of the Monge-Kantorovich distance, which was discussed last week also. So it's good to know that you can do a downsizing of the incompressible theory and you get back to the Monge-Kantorovich theory. So in some sense, in the case of probability measure, you relax the incompressibility constraint, and therefore the motion are made of straight line in some sense, because there is no need for pressure anymore. So this is why the theory is richer, because we can do much more analysis. And so I think the final slide is this one. So this actually, once again, this was what I discussed last week. So you can show that actually the two objects are the same. And this is, for those who don't know the Monge-Kantorovich theory, the distance between two probability measures, mu0 and mu1, with the quadratic cost, is defined as the by minimizing the... You take any joint measure mu with margin mu0 and mu1, and you consider the cost to go from x to y. And you square it in the quadratic case, you minimizing, and this gives you the Monge-Kantorovich distance, the Wasserstein distance, but it can be shown that this is the same as doing this. There is no difference. And because I think the next speaker asked me to remind you of the one of the results he will use, so I remind you this earlier result, which was motivated by the Euler equation, so this result, which actually I think it is fair to say that there was an earlier similar result by Knott and Smith, which is funny because we have the Knott map and the Knott map in some sense for different reasons. And so if you assume at least, I mean for simplicity, that mu0 and mu1 are absolutely continuous with respect to the Lemaitre measure, and d is the unit cube or marginally a nice bounded convex set. So the optimal mu here is really a delta measure on the graph of a map which has a convex potential. And this map is turned out to be convex Lipschitz, and this is the only one which is able to push forward mu0 to mu1. And this was also the starting point of the interest of this theory in the PDE framework, is that this map is a solution to her Monge-Ampère equation. That is the push forward condition analytically writes as follows: the mu1 of grad phi times the Hessian of phi is mu0, and the Hessian of phi is the determinant of the second derivative of phi. So this is Monge-Ampère equation. So the Monge-Ampère equation comes naturally out of the Monge-Kantorovich distance with square cost. And the fact that Monge is involved in the two sides, the Monge-Kantorovich and the Monge-Ampère, seems completely by chance, as my colleague from Nice, Uriel Frisch, has checked. He concluded that there is no obvious relationship between the two fields. And so let me rephrase the introduction of the talk by my conclusion that we started with an infinite dimensional Riemannian geometric problem of geodesics on group of volume preserving maps, for which there is an obstruction to classical solution obtained by Schneeholmann. Then numerical methods based on the combinatorial optimization and permutation give some idea about the way of doing the relaxation. And the relaxation, by a convex relaxation, surprisingly for this problem, turns out to be relevant, at least in 3D, with the main result being the existence and uniqueness of a pressure gradient. And finally, we see that, as a byproduct of the theory, I mean, the Monge-Kantorovich can be revisited with this continuous time variable, which is so important, especially in terms of displacement convexity. Okay, thank you very much for your attention.
Questions?
The microwave, the one is always on the blackboard.
Yes.
What is Knott, you say?
Was well, I think the result of Knott and Smith, I mean, this was actually said in my paper. Yeah. Knott and Smith, I found this paper. Knott and Smith, they were statisticians. So they were looking for random variables and to the way to maximize the correlation between them. Mm-hmm. And they said that the maximal correlation is obtained through the subdifferent that yes. This will be on the subdifferential of convex function, which is basically the same result.
You did not say, but it is what is we call Brinell.
Yeah. So
yes, but I should say that one particular case was in Alexandrov paper of 1942.
Yeah, you see.
Yes, from but
you know, yeah, there is this famous theorem attributed to Arnolds, right?
What?
That every theorem is attributed to a wrong person, and this is true.
No, to Arnold, yeah. Perhaps in the spirit said to some Russian.
Mathematician
before.
Oh, that's right.
Incidentally, I said. Okay, thank you very much.